where I spent 20 years with them.
Working with them. He did this strong film called La Vida Loca, The Crazy Life, which is part of the trailer that we're going to see. And then after the movie opened, he was killed, and he became the first journalist killed in El Salvador after the end of the war. So with that, let's see this short trailer so you get a better sense of what the gangs are or how they look like. Or
he was murdered in September 2009. I don't know if you can read them. Can you?
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
¿Cómo ustedes pretenden que las autoridades respeten derechos humanos si ustedes mismos están violando sus propios derechos humanos?
La 18 siempre ha sido para adelante.
Mi mami, pasita, ¿qué va a decir? ¿Qué va a decir?
This is no fiction. That's probably the toughest part about this film. It's just all completely documentary.
If I may add, Francisca did another great documentary for Swiss TV, so in case you want to check that. We chose this one because we thought in a shorter period of time could give you a good sense of what it is.
So these gangs, you didn't really say, where do they come from?
Yes, well, I'm going to try to make a long story really short. So when these Salvadoran families started to go to California during the 80s, when we had our civil war, they were dismembered families. Maybe the father was killed or the mother stayed behind and they were only children. They went on the streets. And they were just hanging out with other Latino kids. There was this huge gang in LA called the 18th Street. And so the Salvadorans used to hang out with them, but it was just like a kid's thing. And then suddenly they became part of the 18th Street. Then there was a fight in a party, that's how the legend goes, because there's a lot of legend in the gang's narrative, and there's a lot of theatricality, as you can see, and they are all tattooed. So the story goes that in a party they had a big fight, and that's where the Mara Salvatrucha was born. And from then on, they hate each other till death, and they reproduced this hatred when they were deported to El Salvador, they recruited kids in the 90s. Just imagine this country coming out of a very cruel civil war, without any institutionality, in very fragile conditions, very poor, with lots of weapons, and with a very long history of violence. So the cocktail was just perfect for these gang members to come down and just recruit a lot of kids that just had seen violence all their lives. And from then on, in very few years, no one saw them coming because everybody was thinking about how to keep peace between the parties that made the war. So no one was thinking about these kids. And then suddenly gangs became very sophisticated criminal organizations. So that's where we are now.
How did they become so sophisticated? Because at the beginning, they were really tiny, small street gangs rather than good, organized guys.
Well, if you see how a lot of Salvadorans live, or most of them, being a gang member is actually very appealing. It gives you, they are cool, they give you a sense of belonging in a society where the social tissue is very fragile. You have some power when you belong to a gang. So that's very appealing for a kid, 12 years old, 14 years old. And then when the problems started to arise and when the politicians were aware that we had a problem with that, they took advantage of it for their political interests. So they started making political shows, passing laws against gangs that went nowhere. So gangs just became more sophisticated as a way to survive to these ridiculous laws that were never meant to solve the problem, but to address it to have political gains. So you would have the president going with the police chief, kicking doors and arresting a lot of guys. And that was going nowhere, so...
It's because they were, all the guys who were tattooed, they got arrested.
Yes.
Right? It was really easy to detect all the youngsters, like, he has a tattoo, and they really showed it, and that was so easy. And anybody with a tattoo, they put into jail.
Mm.
So huge repression going on.
Exactly.
Yeah.
So the gangs just became more sophisticated, they became more cruel, they... became more experts, and they got in touch with bigger criminal organizations by the time. So right now what we have are gangs that are considered the biggest international criminal organization, according to the FBI, is the Mara Salvatrucha. They are now considered terrorist organizations in El Salvador, but they are now... killing each other in such a rate that El Salvador is now the most violent country on earth, mostly because of what's going on between these two gangs. And no one knows what to do with it. So that's where we are.
Mm-hmm. I think an important problem with that is... Do you have a question?
Yes. Hannah? So is it dangerous for you? I mean, is it
No, this is exactly what I want to write. About this, about him as a journalist, we're going to talk. I just want to just quickly stay with the people, because the people are actually the ones who are fucked.
Yes.
Excuse me. Because what is the problem with extortions? The problem with extortions affects not only the gang members. How can you explain that a little bit?
Yeah, I mean, in the end, it's also a big business for them. So they use their power. Their power is life or death. So they live on extorting small businesses. It's like the old mafia. Have you seen the movies? Like, you pay me in exchange for your security, or you will see how much you need my security. So that's exactly how it works. The thing is that it works with... poor people's business, it works with the public transportation, so it has perverted every single city service or country service. Like, for example, you go into a bus, and then suddenly one of these gang members steps in the bus and shoots the driver because the driver's company has not paid the extortion. So So you're certainly riding a bus with a chauffeur that has just been killed. And this is not an extraordinary thing. This happens a lot. I must say, I can see you raising your hand. Just, I must say briefly that this phenomenon is also present in Guatemala, in Honduras, and in Mexico. So these two gangs are international criminal organizations, and they have a lot of presence also in the United States, although they are much more controlled there, and they are not as violent as they are in... Yes?
Is it purely financial or economical, or does religion have anything to do with it? Is religion important in the ideology of...
No. No, religion just plays a small but very important role in the sense that it's the only way to get out of the gangs. Once you're in, the only way that you're allowed to get out is when you convert to religion. That's the only way to get out. Usually that happens in prisons. So that's the only way for the gang to allow you to get out of the gang. Otherwise, you're killed. It's not only a business. And I think this is a huge difference with other criminal organizations like mafias. Because this is not only money. This is a very complex, like, social thing. It gives disenfranchised people a sense of belonging. It gives a place to be part of, a community, let's put it that way. So it's much more complex. It's not only a criminal organization. Actually, it was not born as such. It was born as a meeting place, as a kids gang. And that spirit is still very much part of the organization. They may commit crimes, they are not only a criminal organization. It's much more complex than that. Yeah. I don't know if that, yeah. Yes?
It sounds obviously like a very male role, but what role do women play in both sides?
Very good question. One of the founders of Mara Salvatrucci is actually a woman, which was one of the first bosses. There are some really tough women that have achieved a leadership status, but that's very uncommon. It's a very male world. Most of the women are basically either the couple of the gang members or the victims of them. Right? We have a lot of problems now in public schools because the gangs have taken in a lot of neighborhoods the schools, as they're basically their turf, so they're raping a lot of women, which also makes it a little bit different from what you would see, for example, in Rio de Janeiro, where you would see a lot of these in the favelas, but their behavior towards women is really different. These guys just don't care. I mean, and we have a lot of murders against women, because the gang member was jealous that she went out with another person. In the documentary that Francisca did, there's a guy that was killed because her girlfriend had just broken up with a gang member, and the gang member was jealous and killed this guy. So this is not extraordinary.
So actually, and it looks like they wanted to kill her and not really...
And he got in the way, yes. Usually they kill both. So women are usually in a second place towards men, but those who manage, and you can imagine what I mean when I say they manage to overcome their second place, they become really tough leaders and they're really followed. But then they have to show so much cruelty to be like accepted by the other men. Yeah, it's a very macho culture. Yes.
Also, maybe just a second, just one word to that. Also, they are used to take drugs inside the prisons, or maybe weapons. They're just being used as as deliverer of something. So.
You talk about some women with big status. I mean, they play a big role. They have leadership. And what is the reason that these women are able to go in leadership?
Give them a gun, and let's see how many people they kill, how cruel they can be, and how, I mean, this is a world where you impose your leadership through violence. That's it. So usually men are more violent than women. When a woman shows to be more violent than men, then she becomes a leader. Yeah. But this is extraordinary. This is not common.
The gangs are very present in Central America. How about the rest of the world?
There's a lot of talk about that. We have seen, I mean, gangs act in a very territorial way. So they even mark their territories. You would see like their graffitis or their siglas, their letters, right? Mm-hmm. On the walls of houses or public spaces. In El Salvador, if they paint your house and you dare to paint it again with white, that only that would deserve you to be killed the next day because you erased their mark. But we have found a lot of these markings in mostly all Latin America, in some European cities, mostly in Spain, some in Italy, and in the United States it's full of these.
In the United States they are pretty big, in the big cities.
Yes, but mostly where the Salvadoran communities are stronger, like that means California, basically Los Angeles, but most of California, Washington D.C., where there's a huge Salvadoran community, and New York. Those are the main cities where you would see this happening. Mm-hmm. And then, of course, in Central America, they are also they also have a really strong presence, mainly in Honduras and Guatemala.
Yeah. At the station Hartbrücke here in Zurich, there's also at some pole there's written Mara. So there is even some crazy copy people just by a joke or by whatever putting Mara on there.
Do you have a picture right here? I'm just interested.
Yeah, I'm sure in the Poveda film there's tons of that. Either there's an 18 or there's an MS. 18 is for the 18th Street Gang, and the MS stands for Mara Salvatrucha. Yeah.
Okay. Dominique, question.
What are the main businesses you're doing? Is it mostly drugs? And what's the reason for the concentration of gang wars in Central America? Is it like just drug demand in the US?
No. They have some business connections with drug cartels and drug dealers, but that's not what they do. These guys don't control the drug traffic.
Okay.
They do services to the drug cartels, but they do not control this.
Okay.
They have presence in most organized crime activities, but then again, it's much more complex than a criminal organization, and they don't see themselves as a criminal organization. It's much more than that. But yes, they traffic weapons, they traffic drugs, they... mostly they do extortions, as I was saying, but they also, some of them, this requires me to explain how they work. It's not a vertical structure. It's very territorial. So every territory has what they call a clique, right? Which is like the group of people representing the Mara Salvatrucha in this neighborhood or the 18th Street Gang in this other neighborhood. So the clique decides how they move their money or how they get their money. So in the old days, some of them were also involved in kidnappings, but it's the clique that does this. Some other cliques are very involved in human smuggling. The corridor that goes from Central America to the United States, it's the biggest human illegal corridor in the world. Right? Nowadays, with the immigration from Syria, maybe that has changed. But for the last 20 years, it has been like the biggest human corridor. So some of the gangs are also involved in that. But again, it's every clique that gets their money on activities that are easier to do in their turf. Yeah. Yes. Most of
the money they have
and the, where are the buses? In prison. So this is a very interesting thing. Let's see if someone has the answer. Why are the people on the streets obeying the orders from somebody that is inside the prison that can't get to you? Why?
Any ideas?
Well, I guess the prison are that locked. You can still control your gang out of the prison, I guess.
Yes, they control them. The question is why they still control them if they are behind bars.
Right. And I guess the bosses in the prison, they know that the street soldier, there is a possibility that every time this specific little man soldier can get catch from the police, and so he has to go to prison, and in prison his life is,
That's exactly the answer. That's why. Because if you are into this world, sooner or later you may end up in prison.
Okay.
And there, exactly that's the reason. And there the boss still rules the world, that world. So the bosses are in prison, and yes, in terms of the money, they have to pay to the higher levels. In terms of the money, that does work like a vertical structure, yes.
Are there lots of killings inside prisons?
There are some. There were in the old days. Now everything's really controlled. Mm-hmm. Like, everybody knows what you can do and what you can't do. And what happened in El Salvador is because there were so many killings, because the gangs' wars from the streets went to the prisons. So now we have separated prisons. These organizations are so huge that we now have prisons just for Mara Salvatrucha and prisons just for Barrio 18, and then prisons for what we call the civilians, as if they were not civilians, right? So they don't kill each other.
Why are you still alive?
Yeah. We're coming to that.
You may have a good question, but no.
Because I have no tattoos. I have no tattoos. No, it's a joke, but it's because I... Yeah.
We're coming to that, right?
Yeah. Yes, okay.
Yeah? Inga?
There's a lot of religious activity, particularly inside the prisons. And there's like a competition between the Catholic Church and the Protestant Church to see who gets more people to their own constituency. So there's always people preaching in prisons. So they convince guys, these gang members, and then when they convert, they go back to the streets converted, and they are allowed to be alive out of the gang. That's the only way to do it.
And what do they do then?
They try to get a living. They usually procreate very young, so when they get out of prison, they have kids. If they are lucky, their wife is still, or their girlfriend, or the mother of his kids is still there waiting to form a family. The converted are pretty much accepted everywhere. Right? So they can even get a job or start their own business with some help from the church especially. So it's not the majority though.
But they still have the tattoos. So
yes.
How can you see that someone is a converted ex-member?
Because as I told you, it works in a very territorial way. So everybody in the neighborhood knows who everybody is. So if you are out of prison but you are converted, then the local gang will leave you in peace. So usually how it works is that, like, let's say from this street to this street is Mara Salvatrucha. So there's no 18th Street gang inside here.
You go back to your neighborhood, yes. And everybody knows, okay, this guy's out.
Or you go somewhere else. It has to be usually a territory still controlled by some clique of your gang. Like, if you have the 18 in your face, you don't go to the MS territory.
But nowadays they don't tattoo. They don't do tattoos anymore.
Yes.
Most, because now they know it's like being branded, so they don't do that. They got a bit smarter.
Yeah. With every measure of the government, they get more and more and more sophisticated. Yeah. So now gangs are not anymore only these kids that you still have, but you have judges, you have lawyers, you have...
One thing I want to point out as well is that it's just an estimate how many gang members, active gang members there are. It's between 60,000 and 80,000?
And 120,000.
Only 120. It's a huge estimate.
Yeah.
And the population of El Salvador is 7 million?
5 million and a half.
It's less now even. Okay,
yeah.
But I had 6.
Inside the territory.
Okay.
Yes.
All right, so inside, right, because so many people live abroad.
Yeah.
Inside the territory, it's 5 million. So imagine, it's a huge amount. But not only this, also the whole family members depend on the extortion money that the gang member earns. So
yeah.
It's just like a whole, like a big part of the society is involucrated in this whole.
Yes.
I would like to move to also a bit to El Faro, to his newspaper and why he survives and all these safety measures
okay.
and stuff. We can still talk about, of course, it's always topic, the Maras. If you have questions about them, we can always ask, or maybe in the end we still have time. Maybe to go to El Faro, we're showing Fred's photos? Fred's pictures?
Yeah, maybe we can show El Faro to them. If we just, do we have internet?
Sure.
Yes.
Yeah.
So you see what we are. So, while you...
So it's actually this.
So this is El Faro. This is a media where I work.
Do you want to go to Sala Negra or?
Yes. Well, yeah. We can show Fred's pictures because
okay.
Yes.
So maybe you have seen these pictures. Familiar to anyone?
Yeah. These pictures won the World Press Photo last year. So let me tell you quickly what it is. There's a place at the forensic office that is only dedicated to identify bones. When victims have been buried for such a long time, you only have bones, and so in this bones inside these clothes. So in this office, they clean the bones and they keep the clothes, and this is where the mothers come looking for their children, right, among other places. So basically, one of the few ways to identify them is through the clothes that were found inside those bones. So Fred Ramos, one of our youngest staff, a very talented photographer, spent 4 months in this office trying to come to a way to illustrate this problem. And he decided in a very clever way just to take pictures of the clothes. Yes, and this was a World Press photo of last year. But I think this is a good way to illustrate kind of the ridiculous, as some call, way that we work, which is a newsroom with only two photographers to send one for 4 months to come up with any idea to do something. And that's the way we work on most of our stories, and our photographic materials. We try to do a lot of full-length stories. As Francisca said, some stories are book-length.
Yes.
yeah.
A lot of them are 20 pages. I print them because I like reading on paper, and when I print them, they're most of the stories are 20 pages.
Yes.
And sometimes you take months to write one.
Yes.
So we're jumping a bit, but it's okay. Is there any demand for that in El Salvador?
Well, curiously enough, El Faro started 17 years ago. So it was, I like to call it pre-Google, because it actually was born before Google. So you can see that's prehistory in the internet world, which was also ridiculous because only less than 1% of the Salvadoran population had the internet. But that also allowed us to make a lot of mistakes without anyone noticing, which is kind of how we learned. But then everybody started telling us we were crazy, because journalism in the internet, especially during those years, everybody thought it's breaking news and very short, right? Do you remember these years? So I think they, in a way, they're still here. And we were just making these huge stories, publishing every week or every time we had them. And everybody said we were crazy, that we were going to die as a media very soon. To our own surprise, these are the materials most read and most visited by our readers, which has confirmed us that there's out there an audience eager for these kind of deep, investigative, well-told news stories, which is what we try to do. We don't always manage to accomplish that, but that's what we try to do. And there's a lot of readership for that. And I think that the reason for why I am here, for example, is because of those stories, not because of the other things that not because of the short stories that everybody else publishes it. So in a way, our aim is not to tell you what happened yesterday, but to try to understand why this is happening and how this is moving, like trying to get deeper into things. And so, to our own surprise, we have been very successful in this. Yeah.
Mm-hmm. This all started in 17 years ago, 1998. Carlos wasn't actually living in El Salvador until 1997, because he lived in Mexico before. They had to flee from El Salvador with the whole family, so they lived in exile. And in 97, he had to basically flee from Mexico because he was a too critical guy, so Mexico exposed him. So he went back to El Salvador, which wasn't the plan.
No.
And you came back, and then you had this idea of creating to change Salvadoran medias. What was bothering you at that time?
The other guy, El Faro, was founded by Jorge Simán, the other founder, and me. We both lived in exile for many years. We are relatives, so we knew each other since we were children. And during the last years, after the war, we would see each other in El Salvador, and we were always complaining that Salvadoran media is basically completely dominated by the oligarchy, by the richest families. So basically, Salvadoran media is always like responding to the agenda of these business people. So we were not satisfied with the quality of Salvadoran journalism, and we had the crazy idea that it was just a matter of enthusiasm to open a newspaper. So we decided to make a newspaper, and then when we got real on that, we started to make numbers, and we thought it was impossible because, you know, the costs of printing, distribution, and we have no money. So, and then suddenly we thought about the internet, and that's how we started. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And the first couple of years, you didn't earn so much money to do that, right?
For the first 7 years, no one earned 1 cent at El Faro, which is why this is not a model for anything. it was just a bunch of crazy, very talented journalists that approached El Faro. They said, well, this is an independent space to do good journalism, and it's a very talented generation. And we were lucky enough, so that's where we started all the process, basically, of learning together. For the first 7 years, no one earned 1 cent. It was all voluntary work. And then, step by step, we started getting some money, and now I am very proud to say that we are like 35 people working there, all with full salary.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And how do you get money? Advertisements?
Sorry?
How do you finance?
Okay, that's a good question, especially with these costs. Sending two people for 4 months to Honduras and Guatemala for one story is not profitable. So we have increased a lot in terms of advertising, but see, the thing with El Faro is that the more money we get, the more we want to do more things. So it's never enough. So we basically receive some funding from some international organizations, especially the Open Society Foundation, which gives us some of the covers some of our budget. And then we also received some money from a couple of Dutch organizations, not Deutsch, but Dutch. I'm learning now. And we also do some other stuff. We sell some of our materials, which is not a big income, but it's some. Because now we basically, what we're doing, we're not only doing this, we have a radio show, we produce books, we produce documentaries. What else do? We organize a huge journalism Latin American Congress every year or two, depending on how we feel. So we're always doing more stuff, which requires more money. So we get money for every project independently. So that's basically how we finance ourselves. But we have increased a lot our advertising sales, which is like the aim. In the end, I don't know any healthy financial model for these kind of things anywhere in the world. And so it's still everything to be experimented, and we're on that path. There's something that we have not taken out of the table, but it's not working in countries like ours because it's poor societies, which is like charging you to read our stories. And we don't want to do that because we think that our stories may have some, we aim for the stories to help to change some things, so we don't want to close that. We opened 2 days ago a crowdfunding campaign that we hope, we're trying to see where it's going to go. And that's what we're always experimenting to see what works and what doesn't.
It's a really professional campaign. Maybe you go. Maybe you can show it, or shall we show it quickly? Do you mind doing so? Because it's really amazing. I find it really amazing how they did it. Can I?
Okay, yeah, please. Yes. Okay.
I hope it's popping. Yeah.
I hope it's popping too.
Yeah, it's popping up. Yeah. So just the way, and then there's usually it's only 26 more days. And then they have this video, which is not popping up now.
She's like, help us dig deeper. That's basically the moment.
Yeah, help us dig deeper. And then you see these guys. It's just really, really good.
It's I'm not going to ask you to open your wallets, but if you want to go, just go.
You are really focusing on this long format and investigative journalism, political analysis, right?
Uh-huh.
And this one investigating part is you're publishing in La Sala Negra, so this is in the dark room, actually. It's violence and organized crime in Central America, politics and corruption, war crimes and historical reconstruction and culture.
Mm-hmm.
You're focusing on these four topics. Why these topics?
Because in a way they are all linked. You may ask what does gangs have to do with a historical reconstruction, as we put it. We investigate a lot of war crimes. Crimes committed during the civil war that we had in the 80s. After the civil war in 1992, peace agreements were signed between the leftist guerrillas and the rightist government. After 100,000 people killed, there was not a single trial. So everything remained in impunity. Mm-hmm. So it's a continuum. If you ask me what remains from the war years, it's impunity and violence. Those are the two continuums, right? So they are absolutely linked, mm-hmm. one to the other. That's why we try to cover all these things. political corruption needs not much to be explained. And then culture, because culture is what nurtures a national narrative. So this is where we can affect change, and we aim to have a conversation with society. I think that we had a picture of a...
Photo.
Yes,
yeah,
yes. Can you... Let me try to explain this picture. This picture was taken in Honduras, which is the second most violent country on Earth. And I want to show you this. Pay attention. These are two girls eating an ice cream, buying an ice cream. They have happy faces. Can you see what's behind them? Is it clear enough? Can you turn off the light a little bit? Is it possible? Thank you.
So is it visible?
Maybe.
Oh, sorry.
Can you see that scene?
Yeah.
Well, that's also culture. That's how people, that's how children grow up. This is in a small city in the Honduran Caribbean shore called La Ceiba. By then, when Daniel Valencia, the reporter, came to write this story, it was the most violent province in the whole Central America. So I think this explains how how the culture of violence, that we're doomed to reproduce it and reproduce it and reproduce it unless we really put our eyes to see what's really happening there. You can't expect a healthy society to grow up when your children are growing up like this. Like, the insensitivity of these girls towards what's behind them. It's like, can you imagine two Swiss girls like this? With a dead body behind them? Like, they don't care? Their faces is like, this is normal for them. I don't have it here, but the other picture that won, the other Salvadoran photographic material that won the World Press Photo is a photo of a school bus where all the children are looking through the window, and there's a dead woman on the street. And that woman, which has a bullet in her head, and her brains are coming out, is the mother of one of the children in the bus. And you see the faces of the kids. What really scares me is not the scene, but the fact that the faces of the kids are so insensible. It's like it's like they are used to see these scenes every day. That's the scary part. So that's why we try to focus on these full-length stories. So we try to understand what's happening with our societies. Instead of counting bodies, we're trying to understand why we have this violence in this region. Yeah.
I also had a quote of somebody when I was down there working, and he told me, this is for many people here coming to a theater piece. If somebody's dead on the streets, they, for example, one told me they don't go to school, they take their kids, and they sit down, they take a chair and sit down, and look what is happening, what is the police doing with the body, so it's just really like entertainment, almost.
It's part of our daily lives, and that's part of the problem.
Yeah.
Yes?
I would like to ask you a question I'm often asked. You are dealing with extreme violence as you are telling us, and how do you feel yourself? What are you doing to keep sane?
That's a great question. Yes. The first thing we do inside El Faro is to admit that we can't be normal if we are exposed every day to this situation. The first thing I have always asked the reporters is, the day that you come from seeing these kind of scenes and you don't feel anything, you're not disgusted, you don't want to vomit, then you're in trouble. Then you can't do your work anymore. So,
but how do you work with nausea all the time then? When you're nauseous all the time, it's not really great working as well.
It is. It is our job to try to understand what's going on. But why are we so obsessed with trying to understand this? Because we know this is not normal. Because we know this is not a functional society. It's disgusting. Right? So you can live with that, because that disgust just helps you to raise more questions. Then look for more answers. Most of the times we don't get them, or we are still on our way to get them. But I think not only that you can work with this ghost, but that you must work with this ghost. Sometimes it's too much. So we do have a program for psychological treatment of our reporters. We don't oblige anybody to go, because if you're obliged, then it will never help you. But it's there, and we've been... See, when we started, like, realizing that we had emotional problems because of this, we started looking for help, for references, mainly in the United States and here in Europe. We found out that, because this is where most of the research is done, right? Psychological, emotional, attention. We found out that there was nothing for us, because most of the European centers and the American psychology centers have these amazing programs for how to how to deal with post-traumatic stress trauma, right? For European and American journalists that go there 3 months and then come back, right? Go to a heat zone for 3 months and then come back. And what happens when you come back? Usually you have nightmares, you have social problems, you don't see anything normal again, and that's called post-traumatic stress trauma, right? And then you have problems related with your family, so they have attention for these people. No one was looking at people like us that we never leave the never leave hell. We live there, so there's no post-traumatic. It's always a present traumatic. So we started learning about these processes and getting in touch with a lot of people that were suddenly interested because then they realized there were people like us in other places of the world that actually needed some other kind of thing. So we have basically come with some programs to take care of ourselves. We can talk about it if you want. But psychologically is that we have psychologists at our disposal, so any journalist that requires them will get them.
What are the roles that other international governments play? Because we usually know that there's always some benefits for this kind of cat, even living abroad, even a government, or a
The role of the other governments, you asked? Well, I mean, the biggest, the most influential country for Salvador, for Central Americans, to no surprise, is the United States. But this is where the problem came. I think it was very irresponsible to deport a lot of gang members when my country was in no condition to receive them. I think they should have seen that this was a perfect cocktail. See, for the United States, the thing is they see it as a big problem, but they try to fight it before it comes to their country. This is the same with the drug policies. It's like, yeah, let's send them money and weapons so they kill all the drug dealers and they fight them, but just before they get to the border, right? From the border on, I don't want anyone hurt in the United States. So, I'm talking about drugs because it's clearer to see it. Like 15 years ago, the United States decided to combat the drug. The drug trafficking was coming from South America through the Caribbean.
You want to show it?
We can get to that later. But just so far, yeah, to let you know quickly. So the United States strategically decided that they needed to change the path of the drug trafficking, so fight them in the Caribbean, because then they would be obliged to come through Central America, which is a small corridor, but it's a continuum corridor, so it would be easy for them to fight them. Well, that's where I live. That's where I live. So this has inflicted an extra problem for the region. So right now in Honduras, that's the main problem they have. Costa Rica, which was like this island, is now starting to be what I call Central Americanized. They are starting to have problems because the drug dealers are coming through that route. We're going to talk about drug trafficking later if you want, or now, whenever you want.
It's coming soon. Dominic?
How do you change the drug traffic? I mean, by as well as you said, US, Central America. How do you do that? That means on the one hand, you have to cut it down in the Caribbean, and on the other hand, you have to build it up. They kind of build it up in Middle America.
I have no idea how you solved that. I have no idea. I just know that it's not our problem,
yeah.
And it shouldn't be our problem. The problem is how much drug trafficking perverts every single state institution and every single way of life in poor countries that can't. I mean, there's no way to compete with what a drug dealer, drug cartel could offer to a judge or to a policeman compared to what our poor states can offer to a judge or a policeman. So that's a problem. If they traffic with drugs, to be honest with you, the drugs end up in New York discos. Our biggest problem in El Salvador is not that the kids are getting drugs. That's not our problem. Our problem is violence. So, I am really, really curious about the fact that there's no drug violence in the United States, except for these crazy kids that kill each other. But it's not like cartels killing each other on the streets of New York, you know?
That's all happening further south.
Yes.
So they all do the...
So that's what I call the David Copperfield effect. It's like, we know every single way of the drugs from Venezuela, Colombia, Bolivia, through Central America, then through Mexico. And then it gets to the border, right? And then it's the David Copperfield effect. It disappears. There's no more drug cartels. There's nothing. It disappears. And then as a magic trick, it appears in a New York discotheque. How did it get from one place to the other? No one knows. It's a magic trick. Because all the fight goes to the south. Look at Mexico now.
I'd like to talk more about you and you work as a journalist and your safety. So you're confronting in El Faro, you're confronting with the powerful people, not only the violent ones, not only the Maras. I mean, like, you're confronting yourself with the government, the drug cartels and corrupt officers, the police and gangs. Is there anyone left?
Yes, we're also confronting the war criminals from the 80s.
Okay,
so yes, we
nice.
Don't have many friends, that's true.
Yeah. Do you manage to live without fear?
No, I mean, I think it's a lie if I told you that I live without fear, or that especially the reporters from El Faro live without fear. That's not the thing. There's always a risk. And you're always worried about it. And the more and more we're conscious, we're more worried about this. And the trick is, how do we manage to live with fear? Not without fear, but with fear. That's the thing. Yeah. To be honest with you, I don't think we're very brave. I mean, really. I mean, you know who I think are very brave people? Our colleagues in Mexico or our colleagues in Honduras. They are being killed. We are under a high risk, but nothing has happened yet, right? I don't know if I could be practicing journalism in Mexico, to be honest with you, but they are. Their situation is way worse. So I don't see myself as an example of bravery or courage or the people that work with me. I think that the difference is that we have managed to come, because we're worried about this, to come with this knowledge about how to protect ourselves. So far it has worked, so far. More and more we increase our security measures to make it safer. But then it gets just ridiculous. So let me tell you this story quickly. One day we received threats from a drug cartel, right? So the Minister of Security called me to his office and said that he was assigning 4 policemen to take care of me and 4 reporters. And so we were going everywhere with 4 policemen. You can't interview anybody with 4 policemen. So it got so ridiculous that we were running away from our security to meet with the drug dealers, to have a story. One of those weeks I remember, because we laughed so hard, with 2 reporters, we ran away from our policemen. In the same week, we interviewed 3 hitmen from 3 different decades. So it's like one was a hitman from the war years, another was a hitman from a massacre, and the last one was a hitman from a drug cartel. So you can't show up with 4 policemen to interview them, of course. So So yeah, those kind of measures won't work. Yeah.
There's also one security measure that for him is normal. All the houses are surveyed, and also you have to pass a guard. And there's a man, there's,
yes,
24 hours guards that protect the newspaper and the whole area. So it's just, that's also maybe important to know, also the way you guys live. Most of them live kind of almost in gated, not really gated communities, but still there is plenty of securities all over.
Yes, that's true. Yes, that's true. That's not nice, but that's, yeah.
That's also, he said, it's so nice to walk around here without constantly
looking
back.
I'm so happy here.
And also when he was living, and this is what I want to also touch at least, his project that he is or has been doing or still has to finish a book. And he was living in New York for a year.
Yes.
When you came back, so you told me when you came back from New York, at first you walked in Salvador Street, San Salvador Street, without looking back, and everybody was like, hey, Carlos, watch out. Like, how, this is a complete different world, huh?
Yeah, when I moved to New York, the hardest thing for me was to get used that I didn't need to look to my back. Like, to lower the guard and just enjoy, like this, just enjoy this. So I just moved back after a year couple of months, like 14 months, and I went back to San Salvador with the guard totally low, like, and everybody was like, man, we're in a situation here, you can't do that, and I was like, I have to get used to this again, and that part is not funny, that's a part of the job that I don't like, but it comes with it. Yeah, it's not funny to be all the time, like, paranoid, no, it's not, and I wish I didn't need to, really. I wish we didn't need to. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Okay. I would like to jump to one last topic, which is very important for you.
Yes.
It's this book about the killing of this Archbishop Oscar Romero, and this was 35 years ago. This murder happened a really long time ago, when you were really
9 years
when
old.
When you were 9 years old. Why are you working on a murder that happened so long time ago?
Why am I working on a murder that happened such a long time ago? Good question. The murder of our Archbishop Romero was the Archbishop of San Salvador. He was killed while giving mass on March 24th, 1980. He was giving mass in a small chapel. A sniper came and shot him. One clean shot to his heart. It was a death squad. Monsignor Romero had become like the voice of the poor people in a very repressive situation where people protesting against the military regime would get killed. So he was the place where all the poor people would go to say, my husband is missing, disappeared yesterday, three men took him. He became like the human rights department of the country, and his Sunday masses were specially followed by everybody. It was like, there's these stories that are true, that you could walk from small village to small village throughout the whole country on Sunday, listening to Monsignor Romero's homily, because everybody was listening through the radio all around the country. So he raised as the really voice, we call him the voice of the voiceless. Right? That's what he became. And he became an obstacle for the military that wanted to get into an open war, because that's a huge business for the military. And that's what happened. So they killed him, and the war started as a product of that killing. And the war lasted for 12 years. The thing is that no one has been accused of this murder. The leader of the death squad was a retired Salvadoran military called Roberto Davison. After he killed Romero, he went into politics. He opened a political party that ended up governing El Salvador for 20 years. So this murder has never been tried as any other war crime. I think Archbishop Romero is the most universal of Salvadorans. So for me, talking about this murder is explaining all that we've been talking about, all the impunity, all the violence, all the culture of violence that has ruined my country. Like, if you review the story of my country, it's culturally violent because it has always been the most efficient way to solve things, with a gun. A gun has always been more efficient than any court, any tribunal, anything. Mm-hmm. So, for me, talking about this murder is talking about everything that's been wrong in my country.
Okay. There is also an article, Así Matamos Monseñor Romero, and that's how we killed Archbishop Romero. And this is in English as well. I just don't have it open. You published an interview, a very extraordinary interview with one guy who was participating in the murder.
Yes.
So also this link is, he finds this murder, or part of the murder, he finds this person in a village, which is this most disgusting place on earth. Like, he's explaining it's about worms and I don't know, you name it, but it's just so crazy. This guy is hidden in a place, and he found it after 5 years, he found him after 5 years of investigating. So that's if you want to go a bit deeper into that.
Yeah, if you're interested, I can tell you more about this.
We don't have so much more.
Okay, so I'm going to try to make a long story quick. Sure. This guy is the same guy. I don't know if you can see him. No, I mean, you can appreciate it here. But this guy was the security chief of Roberto Lagos, the guy I told you. And this is the guy that operated the killing of Archbishop Romero, Captain Sarabia. So, through a very weird law in the United States, a group of lawyers found out that he was living in Modesto, California, and they managed to bring him to a civil trial through a very strange law. When this guy found out, he ran away. He was still judged in California. I attended that trial in absence. He was still judged, but he was not there. He ran away. He was found guilty, and it was the first time in history that someone was found guilty of a crime against humanity for a single murder, which is the murder of Archbishop Romero. It was considered a crime against humanity. But he was nowhere to be found. So I started looking for this guy, and it took me 5 years to find him. I found him in a remote, really remote, small town in Central America.
Which is secret, you have to keep it secret.
Yeah. He was hiding, he changed his name, he was living under really poor conditions, miserable conditions. That's why this fat became this thin, old, fragile guy in just a couple of years. So we started talking, so I went to visit him like 9 or 10 times in the course of 3 or 4 years. And then, he confessed most of what he did, he confessed. And then from there on, I just went and interviewed like 60 other people to run this story for the 30th anniversary of the killing of Archbishop Romero. So this is the story about what happened, how they managed to plan the killing, where they met, where they slept that night, how they went to kill him, blah, blah, blah. That's the story of what happened. So now I'm trying to write a book to explain what allowed them to do this with such impunity. And yeah, it turns out that the answer is the Cold War, which is for me the interesting part of this. Romero was abandoned by his own church because the Cold War also affected the church. The church was going through a lot of changes. Do you remember Vatican II and the progressive church that demanded the Catholics to leave the altars, to stop speaking in Latin in the churches, and to approach poor people and serve them? So this really caught fire in Latin America. There was a lot of progressive church, priests that started with the theology of liberation, blah, blah, blah. The needs were huge. And then Romero becomes archbishop, and he's basically transformed into this person to serve the poor. Right? While the country was ruled by a military rightist regime. And this is very important because then something happens in the Vatican. A new pope from Poland comes in, whose name is John Paul II. Why is this important? Because this guy had no clue about how to deal with Latin American problems. Because for him, resisting dictatorship was fighting against communism. And someone told him that in Latin America, it was the military regimes that were stopping the communists. So he could not understand anything else. So he basically abandoned Romero. This is just a brief example of how the Cold War in the end, of why this killing in the end becomes a story of the Cold War for me. The role of the United States, the role of the Soviet Union, and how my country became the battlefield and all the political interests behind that. How the army was supported by the United States. How the rebel forces were supported by Cuba and Nicaragua, the Sandinista Nicaragua, and how El Salvador became the biggest story on earth because the Americans were so worried that after Nicaragua, El Salvador would fall, and then the domino would start spreading the virus of communism throughout the region. So that's basically the book I'm trying to finish, yes.
So we have to, probably have to read it. And when are you planning to finish that?
Yes, that's a story that appeared in the New Yorker in May, yeah. If you're interested. I wrote it in, last May. I wrote it because Romero was beatified last May in San Salvador. So, this is in English, so it will be easier for you to read.
And when are you planning on finishing your book? Okay, question, Inga?
And how did you get this sergeant?
I'm sorry?
This sergeant who committed the...
Yes, okay. Well, I looked for him like for a couple of years. Someone told me that I knew what he was doing in California. He was selling cars, used cars. He had a used car lot. So I learned that this was managed by a mafia from Iraq called Ball 8. Yeah. In California, the used car lots are managed by an Iraqi mafia called Ball 8. So in California and Chicago. And the kings of the Ball 8 are in Chicago. So I went to Chicago to look for this guy. I couldn't find him anywhere. So I called the lawyer that had accused him. And I told her, brave woman, Almudena Bernabeu. I told her, listen, this guy's going to call you sooner or later. He can't run away forever. He's going to try to make a deal with you. Right? I don't care what you do. Just let him know that I'm tired of looking for him. That I want to talk to him. And curiously enough, it worked. It took a couple of extra years, but that's exactly what happened. This guy calls her. They started conversations, negotiating about how to deal with this. They didn't get anywhere, but the guy accepted to talk to me. I know why he did it. He didn't tell me everything. He just wanted to send the message that he knew. He was using me, of course. Yeah. Like, not giving me all the information, but giving me enough information to send the message that he was ready to talk, to send the message to everybody so he could get some help, because he was miserable. Yeah, he was starving. I don't know what happened with him.
Yeah.
No, we lost contact when I published the story. He just called me one day and said he was leaving the place where he had been living, and he had found some financial help to move. He didn't tell me where, and I never heard from him again. Yeah.
We have time for two more questions, if there are, concerning the Maras or Romero or Carlos.
Or El Faro.
Oh, El Faro. No?
No.
Okay. No.
Maybe just, I know it's a huge question, but if you can just give a broad answer. What has to happen in order to stop the violence in El Salvador? Do you see any way to the violence can be stopped?
I don't see how. I just have hope, because if not, I mean, my work has no sense. I mean, you can't work under these conditions if you have no hope that things may change. Then you just surrender. I do know that if we had started 20 years ago, things would be different today. Archbishop Romero used to say that violence is a structural thing, that you will never solve it unless you go to its causes. So these gang members, they didn't come on a spaceship. They are part of our society, of a very dysfunctional society. So if you don't invest in correcting the causes or the situation on how most of the population live, the inequality gap that is insulting, the lack of education, the lack of social services, the lack of the presence of the state in these areas. But these won't solve the problem for tomorrow. It will take 20 years. This is what I'm at least. Now, maybe, I don't know. But if we had started 20 years ago, instead of taking political show measures to take the problem seriously and invest on that, I don't think we would have that problem now. We have an extra problem with this. According to the World Bank, more than half of Salvadoran professionals already left the country. I think you can manage to fix social problems, but you can't do that if people don't believe there's something to do. If you don't have people to... The last polls show that half of Salvadorans are actively looking for ways to leave the country. We already have a third of our population living abroad. The remittances they send are the main income in the country. We are copying a consumist culture, so now El Salvador is one of the most consumerist societies on earth, and it's a very poor country. So it's like nothing's working, so people have no hope. If you have no hope, I don't see any way to fix a society. You need hope from the people. You need people eager to do something as a society, because the only other solution is to expect one person, and I don't believe in those kind of solutions, that one person will solve the problem. It has to be a society, especially, I believe, the middle class. But we're losing the middle class. They are leaving. And it's natural that they leave. If I had a family, I would leave. I don't want my kids to grow up there. So that's what happened. So I still have hopes, but I every day have more trouble to keep those hopes on the ground, if you understand what I mean.
Okay. Carlos, thank you so much for coming. He's now traveling to Sweden. There he's also invited for a conference.
Yeah. I have to say that we have great coffee, so we don't end with a negative tone.
Yeah,
we have some of the best coffee in the world.
Thank you so much.
Thank you.